We're continuing on in our study of Haman. As I mentioned this morning, I couldn't resist. I had titled the sermon tonight, Hanging Haman High. Just the opportunity was there. I couldn't pass it up. So go ahead and turn in your Bibles. We'll be picking up in the seventh chapter of Esther as we're studying through this book in our evening services. If you recall, last week we swung through the pivot point in the story of Esther. We've been watching the characters develop, and we've seen how everything was coming together in opposition to the Jews, specifically to Esther and Mordecai. And then last week we saw the transformation as the destinies began to reverse. The destinies of the primary characters changed on one providential night of sleeplessness that King Xerxes had. And when that change occurred, if you recall, last week, none of our primary characters, Esther, Mordecai, Haman, none of them were involved in the events of that night. And at that point, in that scene where everything transferred or transformed, began to change direction, we saw the primary message of the book. God is the primary character in every drama. He is in control. We can find confidence that He is in control of every storyline in each of our lives. Learning that lesson will help us as we go through our lives to be steadfast, be sober-minded, all those things that are a mark of spiritual maturity as we come to acknowledge that God is in control. Well, tonight we continue our story from that point. We still have not reached the climax. We're still building in tension. Even though we've went through the pivot and the characters are starting to reverse destinies, we're still building towards the climax. The climax of a story is reached when the primary tension is resolved. At this point, the Jews still have a death sentence upon them that has not been resolved yet. But we will see a strong possession tonight towards the climax. Tonight is a night where we have a lot of action, so the pace of our narrative quickens significantly. We'll pick up our story a very short time after we left it off last week. If we recall, even while Haman was lamenting the day that he had to his wife and his friends, if you remember, he was telling them how miserable it had been. He had been forced to give honor to his greatest enemy across the whole city. He was telling them how bad things were, and while he was still doing that, the messengers arrived at the door to convey him to the second banquet of Esther. So the scene we're opening up on tonight follows right on the heels of what we saw last week. Only a few moments have transpired in between. But tonight we open up on our scene once again in Esther's banquet hall, where only the queen, the king, and Haman are present. We'll see that Esther is not directly in control of her destiny even at this point, but she is taking the initiative. She's the one forcing events to move forward. Let's look at verse 1. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. Presumably, when we see the banquet here, as we move into this scene, we're not too late in the day, probably late afternoon. We've had enough time to elapse for Haman to come before the king to tell him to go honor Mordecai. Haman took and honored Mordecai through the city, went home, complained about it, and was brought back to the banquet. But it cannot be very late in the day because we'll see as we go through tonight, a lot of things occur yet before the day is over. So probably late afternoon time frame, we're having this banquet. We know it's on the same day that Haman ushered Mordecai through the city in honor. The banquet has come, and here they are sitting, just the three of them together. So let's watch as the hammer begins to fall on Haman's plan. Verse 2. And the king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther replied, If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, Who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? Esther said, A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. So here we are now, for the third time, the king is asking Esther, what is your request? He asked her when she approached his throne room unrequested, risked her own life. And he was intrigued, and he asked her, why are you here? What is your request? What's your petition? He asked her again on the night of the first banquet. And now he asks a third time. Notice that even as he asks her, he addresses her as Queen Esther. And he indicates that he's still very favorably disposed to her. What is it that you want? I will grant up to half my kingdom. The fact that she's made him wait for 2 days and asked three times has intrigued him rather than frustrated him. He again assures her that he's going to grant whatever it is. If it's within his power, I will grant it. Esther finally now responds to the request, doesn't she? She answers him, here's what I want. And notice the way she words her answer. The king has consistently, every time he asks her, he asks, what is your request? What is your petition? Using those two terms as synonyms for one thing. Esther responds here by saying her life is her petition, and her people are her request. By wording like that, she immediately links herself and her people together as one. She makes a connection there and shares instantly a common destiny and says, I have one request for me and my people. We're united. We cannot be separated. She has automatically placed herself by doing that under the death decree that comes with that connection. Esther goes on in her petition. She uses the exact same wording that Haman used in his decree when he issued it. She uses destroyed, killed, and annihilated. Matches up exactly with what Haman wrote in the letters back in chapter 3, verse 13, when he sent those letters out to all the cities of the land announcing his decree to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jews. There can be no doubt which decree she's referring to at this point. The other thing I want you to notice is Esther is very careful in how she words her petition. In the final analysis here, think about it, the decree against the Jews really comes out under the authority of the king, right? It was his signet ring that stamped and made it law. It's his authority that guarantees this decree. But she's very careful when she words it. She's careful to make sure that it will not sound like she's blaming him for anything. She really, at this point, can't know who has more influence. Does Haman or does she? You have to remember, at this point in time, until the banquet yesterday, she hadn't even seen the king for over 30 days. Haman has seen the king every day. He's the second most powerful man in the empire at the time when men are very important. We've already seen at the beginning of the book, queens are rather disposable. Esther doesn't know who has more influence here, which of us. So she's very careful how she words her request to make sure that none of the blame goes towards the king in any way that would cause him to be insulted. Esther comes as close as anything blaming the king for culpability when she states that she and her people have been sold. That's most likely a reference to what Haman offered to pay into the king's treasuries. If you let me annihilate these people, I'll put this much money into his treasury. So that could possibly be a little illusion, king, you let this happen. But that's as close as she gets. From there on, none of the blame lands directly on the king, either with agreeing to the decree too quickly, having it sent out. She's careful to make sure that he's not the one she points fingers at. The last phrase here, when you look at verse 4 in the various Bibles, you may find that it's translated different ways. It's a very difficult verse in the Hebrew to translate, but it does seem to have some sort of an idea here that if this decree were anything of a lesser nature, she wouldn't bother to waste the king's time with it. She wouldn't bother to bring it up. It is not important enough for her to bring up if it wasn't death. So it's only the fact that this is such a significant decree that she would even bother to bring it up. So throughout here, she's walking a very dangerous tightrope. She's making sure that she explains the issue, shows the king how serious it is, but doesn't blame him for it. The irony of verse 5 is very strong when you look at it. The king asks Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? The king is still clueless. He doesn't have any idea what decree Esther is talking about. You know, it's only been about 2 months since the decree went out for him to annihilate an entire people. But he had no concern about it at that time. Remember, he just said, go, do what you want. He never even asked who the people were. And it's long forgotten from his mind. He has no idea what she's talking about. All he knows is that he's learning here that there's a threat on his queen's life. So he learns this on the exact same day, if you remember, he couldn't sleep. And during the course of not being able to sleep, he remembered a threat that was made to his life. So now, I remember a threat was made to my life, now there's a threat to my queen's life. That's enough to get him riled. That's an affront to the king's honor. Who would do such a thing? You know, you think about it, he's probably even still tired from lack of sleep. Not the most patient man. Who would do this? He can't imagine it, and he's angry. Who would dare threaten his queen? And why would she be so afraid to tell him that she's gone through this long ordeal to draw it out? The king doesn't have any idea. But one can only wonder what's going through Haman's mind at this point. I'm sure he recognizes the words of the decree. Up till this point, he has no idea that Esther is a Jew. But as soon as she says that they were given over to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated, I'm sure he knew instantly what she was talking about. He would recognize that reference to the words that he himself had penned. He probably sensed the finger that was about to point towards him. You know, I expect this is probably the time he's trying to blend real hard into the furniture and not be seen anywhere in the room. How can he hide? So the king asks his question. And as he does, Esther turns and she points her finger at Haman. He's the man. A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Bam, the shoe drops, doesn't it? He never saw it coming. The shoe drops, and the accusation, I expect, just hung in the air. You can almost sense the silence that would be behind the wicked Haman. What do you say after that? I expect Haman turned white as can be. He went pale. But the king probably went through a whole bunch of other shades of color. You know, he's had a little bit of wine. He's already angry. Now he's going to be even more angry. I expect we see all kinds of shades of red going through his face. Here it is, his most trusted advisor, his number two man, has put a threat to kill his queen. What an insult. What a traitor. You know, even if the king has moved on from Esther, he hasn't been with her for the last 30 days, he's moved on, she's still the queen. And an insult, a threat to her, is a threat to his throne. It's an insult to the king himself. A threat to her would be a disdain for him. How could a number two man possibly do that? An attempt against her was a mark against his honor. The king would be livid with rage at this point. Now remember, Haman, I'm sure, has not risen to his position without being able to read the king fairly well. He could probably read the most subtle of moods in the king. I expect there was nothing subtle at this point. The king's face would give it all away. And it says Haman became terrified. There was absolutely nothing subtle about the king's mood this time. But look at what happens next. Verse 7. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now the king returned from the palace garden into the palace where they were drinking wine. Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbonah, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. The downfall here of Haman occurs at unbelievable pace. You know, in well under a day, he goes from being the second most powerful man in the most powerful empire on earth at this time to being dead. That's a pretty quick fall. He's dead, not just is he dead, he's dead as a traitor who's hung in a most despicable manner. You know, the king's leaving the room here sets the stage for the final instant that seals Haman's fate. If there was any doubt in the king's mind, this puts it to rest. The king is most likely still playing mental catch-up at this point. He has no idea of any of the stuff that's been going on, and it's all just come out, boom, somebody's trying to kill my queen, it's him. His mind's reeling through it. We don't know how much wine he's had, but that probably slowed it down a little bit more even. And he's playing catch-up, so he walks outside to figure out, what should I do? Give me a moment to think. Now, according to historians, Persian palace protocol dictated that no man other than the king would ever be alone in a room with the queen. The king's expectation would have been that protocol would be followed. The minute he walked out of the room, the expectation would be Haman would leave too. But instead, Haman remains behind to plead for his life. He could see the king's mood had shifted completely against him at this point, and he knew his only chance, only possibility he had to save himself would be to get Esther to somehow plead on his behalf. So he stays behind to have her plead, or to plead with her for his life. Now, protocol not only required that Haman should have left the room at this point, but apparently there was also a requirement that men would remain at least 7 steps from any member of the king's harem. Even when they were allowed to approach, there was supposed to be 7 steps in between. When the king walked back in from the garden, he found that Haman had violated this protocol as well. He walks into a scene here where Haman is falling on the couch. Now, it wasn't until I started studying this, because I always scratch my head, that it just doesn't make sense. Well, the commentators that I read helped me understand is most likely that Haman was not actually assaulting Esther at this point. Rather, he was probably kneeling right at her couch, grabbing her, begging, pleading, maybe even shaking her feet or her hands, pleading for his life. You know, undoubtedly, even though no one was to be in the room with her, that didn't include attendants. There was always attendants around. We're in the banquet hall, so you would have had attendants around. You would have had servants stationed around the outskirts of the room. Palace matters were always discussed in their presence as if they weren't even there. So they wouldn't be called out. But we can see, you know, Harbonah comes just like that. As soon as the king issues his words, there's immediately somebody there grabbing Haman. So most likely they're not just the two of them in the room. There's other people. So it's not like he's assaulting her so that there's a physical threat to her life, but he is once again completely violating protocol. And that is an affront to the honor of the king. You will not follow the king's honor if you will not follow the protocol in his own palace. So we see here that as soon as the king speaks, the attendants and the eunuch are there and they grab Haman, they cover his face. As I said, they were probably in the room the whole time, and they never raised the alarm of danger, but they definitely observed this breach of protocol. So the king walks in. He sees Haman here, grabbing her hands, her feet, begging for mercy. And he is even more livid. He is even more upset. The king walked in and interpreted this as disrespect for his honor, his authority, the most serious affront to him right in front of his face. So if there was any doubt remaining when he walked out, there was no doubt now what he was going to do. He orders his attendants to immediately grab Haman, and the fact here that they cover his face, that indicates that the king ordered him be taken away for execution. They cover the face of a condemned prisoner when they let him out for execution. Again, look at the irony of the scene here. Think about it for just a moment. Everything started because Haman was offended that one Jew would not bow down to him. Haman's pride couldn't endure the perceived affront that would represent to him. But in the end here, it's Haman who's kneeling to a Jew, and a woman at that. He was kneeling in complete humility, begging for his life before a Jew, rather than being affronted that a Jew would not bow to him. There's also irony in his death here. As soon as the king orders Haman's execution, Harbonah steps forward with this suggestion that we saw. He sees the king responding to suggestions all the time, and Harbonas steps forward and says, you know, Haman has these gallows built for Mordecai, who's spoken good on your behalf. Again, the king was oblivious to what was going on in the city, but his attendants knew everything going on. They knew what was happening out there in the city, and Harbonah right away was able to connect the dots for the king and say, you know, Haman has gallows built. You want him killed, we've got a place we can do it. This is a man who wants to do evil to those who have done good to the king, is the implication. Harbonah is basically saying he's a self-serving traitor. He doesn't even care about what's best for the king because he wants to hang the man who did good for the king. Now Xerxes, who throughout the entire book never seems to have an independent idea on his own, once again follows this idea. He says that's a fitting end for a traitor. And he orders that be carried out immediately. Now this is a bit gruesome, but we should probably not think about these gallows in our way of thinking. It's not like American gallows where a person hung from a rope and were asphyxiated for their death. There's not really an English word that matches up for the Hebrew word here, but historians believe that the means of Haman's death here was he was actually impaled on a wooden stake that was put up high on a platform. They called it a gallows, but that it wasn't, like I said, hanging. He was impaled and hung and stuck up there for everyone to see. As one commentator put it, this verse displays the true destiny of human evil. It comes quickly and without warning. Haman never saw it coming when he got up that morning. He got up thinking the day was going to be his day of putting down his greatest enemy. But wicked never sees it coming. Now, before we move on, I want to take just a moment and consider some of the ramifications of the events we've discussed. This is a scene that many people who are trying to look at Esther as some sort of a role model struggle with. I told you when we began this study that many people look for a role model type of message here. And that's not the purpose of this book. And this is one of the scenes that they struggle if they try to use Esther as a positive role model. Wouldn't it have been more Christian for Esther to show mercy to her enemy? Shouldn't she have demonstrated unconditional forgiveness by responding positively to Haman's pleas? That's the kind of questions that people wrestle with. And if you read those that are trying to use her as a moral example, they try to explain away this action. But they're missing the message of the book. The fundamental problem with these questions is they're missing what the book is all about. Esther is not presented to us as a positive role model that we're to emulate. That's not the purpose here. Our focus should not be on her. Our focus should be on God. God is the primary character. God is the one moving. God is the message that we're to see here. In this scene, once again, we see God moving. We see God using civil government to accomplish his purposes. The faithful execution of all of his promises to preserve his people are being administered through a civil government. God is making it happen. God's promise to preserve the nation of Israel, they're his chosen people. He cannot let anything happen to them. Haman has proven himself to be an enemy of God because he attempted to destroy God's people. No other interpretation can be put around it. He is against God. So I think the lesson for us to learn here is that we have to be careful that we never align ourselves with enemies of God. If Esther were to have given mercy to Haman, she would have been aligning herself with an enemy of God. We live in a day that talks constantly about having unconditional spirit of forgiveness, an unconditional demonstration of love, but that's not the biblical perspective. It's always a difficult balance, and a lot of wisdom is required to understand when should we forgive, when should we not. But there are times when we must not show mercy. We must withhold it because to show mercy would be to align ourselves with enemies of God, and we can never do that. The general principle that we have to use when we base what decision should we show mercy or not, I believe, is demonstrated here. If the person has demonstrated that by his life and by his actions that he is aligned and committed to being against God, we dare not align with him. we must hold fast in opposition to him. Our love for God and our love for God's truth demands that. Esther could have been faithful to God if she had granted, or Esther could not have been faithful to God if she granted mercy to Haman. Haman was God's enemy. And neither can we at times. There are times where we must love God sufficiently to stand in unflinching opposition to those who made themselves enemies of God. If we look back here at the end of the scene, obviously the execution was carried out immediately. With Haman's death, we're told that at that point the king's anger subsided. That most likely indicates that the king was more enraged over the affront to his honor and to his throne, the affront that was contained in the threat to the queen, than he was over the fact that the queen's people were scheduled for execution. You know, it was just a passing thought about the annihilation of an entire people. The king is still a very fickle ancient Persian tyrant. An affront to him is a serious thing. A threat to a whole people, not so serious. So let's see what happens next in this eventful evening. The evening is still not over. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed that he was what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Since Haman had been executed as a traitor here, his property was confiscated by the king. It became property of the crown, because the crown takes any traitor's property. And Xerxes, in turn, gives this over to Esther. I suppose it was compensation for her, mental anguish or her suffering that she had. Anyway, as favor to her, he gave her all of Haman's properties. Symbolically, though, that becomes the next step in the reversal of destinies. Haman had planned, if you recall, on confiscating all the properties of the Jews when he annihilated them so that he could pay it into the treasury. Instead, all of his property was handed over to a Jew. The reversal is continuing. Now, at long last here, Esther is finally able to reveal to the king who Mordecai really is to her, what the relationship is. Since she has told the king that she's a Jew, there's no reason to keep that relationship secret anymore. So Mordecai is called in. She sends for him. We presume he's probably still in his office. And we saw at the end of his honoring that last week that he went back to his office, right back to work. Apparently he's still there working diligently, probably to make up for things he didn't get done while he was being honored in the city. He's still there. So they call him in, and she presents him to the king as her cousin that had raised her when she was an orphan. Talk about coincidences. You know, Mordecai has already been on the king's mind a lot this day. You know, a man that he probably hadn't thought of for a couple years now has been on his mind throughout the whole day. He'd stumbled on Mordecai's service during his sleepless night. He had had Haman honor him greatly that morning. Now he finds out that the same man is like a father to his queen. Undoubtedly, Esther's probably supplying additional details as she's going through, as she presents Mordecai, that attest to how faithful of a character he is. The end result of all of this is that the king immediately promotes Mordecai to the latest palace opening that he has, Haman's spot. He gives Mordecai a signet ring and promotes him to that position. Mordecai now is second in command in the kingdom. Esther further rewards Mordecai by placing him over the house of Haman, the very man who Haman was determined to bring down all along and take everything from, now owns everything that Haman had and held dear. But the primary problem still remains. Even though Haman is dead, the death sentence is still hanging over the head of the Jews. That hasn't changed. The Jews are still condemned by Haman's original decree. So let's look at verse 3. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his face, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. Then she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, Let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Now this is most likely a continuation of the previous discussion. You know, we're not told for sure, but sure have that feel to it, that we're still in Esther's banquet hall. We've just promoted Mordecai. The king's ready to call it a day. Things have been resolved. And Esther, once again, falls on her face before the king to bring his attention back to the urgent matter that she raised originally. You know, the king's no longer angry. He's forgotten about the original request. But even though her life, and I expect Mordecai's, was in all likelihood safe at this point, Esther couldn't leave the situation with the Jews unresolved. She had to address it. So once again, she falls here and pleads with the king for the people. Now we have to remember that the king has shown time and time again that he's a very fickle monarch. He has been an emotional roller coaster all day long, hasn't he? Up and down. He's most likely drunk a fair amount of wine. There's no guarantee that he would tolerate additional pleading from Esther. But Esther's willing to risk it anyway. Once again, the king does show favor towards her. You know, we're reminded, once again, God controls the heart, even of this fickle king. And he has once again caused this king to be favorable in disposition towards Esther. So the king again asks her to tell him what she would have him do about the situation. I want you to notice how carefully Esther approaches him in verse 5. If it pleases the king, and if I found favor before him, and if the matter seems proper to the king, and if I'm pleasing in his sight. She's really playing it up, isn't she? She's laying it on really thick. I think she understands the magnitude of what she's about to ask. And she wants to use everything she can to remind the king, this is a personal favor to me. Think about what she's about to ask him. She's asking the king to change an official decree. What does that mean? In essence, she's asking the king to publicly admit that he was wrong about something. You know, the fact that he didn't actually write the decree, Haman did. It went out with the king's signet ring. It has his authority behind it. For him to change it, to pull it back the way she's asking, he basically is telling his entire empire that he's changed his mind and he wrote a bad law and he's going to undo it. That's not the type of thing that a proud ancient monarch is prone to do. They weren't well known for admitting they were wrong. It was easier to just lop off the next person's head and move on. But Esther's clever, even in her wording. She's careful all the way through here to continue to lay the blame on Haman for the decree. Even though the reality is Haman could not have issued the decree without the king's authority, she's careful to point again to Haman for doing everything. And she doesn't place the king's authority that's behind it in focus here. She never accuses the king in any way of being directly involved in the matter. Instead, she makes an emotional plea as his wife. She uses every aspect of emotion she can pluck, I think, here as she goes, how can I endure to see the calamity? How can I endure to see the destruction? How can I endure it? In other words, how can she ever be a happy queen again if he doesn't prevent the destruction of her people? Esther knows he's an emotional king, so she plays on his emotions completely. So, does it work? As we finish tonight, let's look at the king's response. Verse 7, so the king, Ahasuerus, said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. What I think is significant here is that Esther continues to be presented as the one who's initiating things. The king is still simply responding to her initiative all the way through. He starts here by recounting everything he's done already for her and Mordecai this evening. Look at what I've done already. He's done much to defend her honor. Why should she still be frustrated? He set the matter right already. She's no longer in a threat, and Mordecai's been promoted. But now she's asking him to do something very difficult. You know, this foolish queen just doesn't understand is kind of the impression you have here at first. He explains that the decree of Haman is law. It cannot be revoked. We can probably read that's not the answer that's going to fly with his queen tonight. So Xerxes almost seems like he's being careful as he moves on to not get directly involved. But he does offer a possible out to Esther and Mordecai. He says you, and that you is actually a plural you. He's addressing both of them, the two of you, both of you. You could write a second unalterable decree that would essentially cancel the first decree. The first decree cannot be revoked, but it could be neutralized. Remember, you now have the authority in your hands to do that. You know, the king's still playing his politics. He's not going to get involved directly, but he does. Here's a possible out. You could do this. You can cancel it if you're clever enough to do it. Now, we'll stop here tonight in the same manner that I expect this was the end of the night's events for Esther and Mordecai. It's been a long day, a lot of surprising twists and turns. Next week, we'll look at what plan they come up with to neutralize Haman's decree. But as we conclude, I want us to think about a couple things here. First of all, the author has been careful all the way through to make the point that those who attack the Jews will fail. He puts this very point into the king's mouth even here in verse 7 when Xerxes says Haman was hanged because he had stretched out his hand against the Jews. It wasn't because he had threatened the queen, according to the king, it's because he stretched his hands out against the Jews. Esther just reminded him of that. God's promises to his people will stand. We know from the remainder of the Gospels, or the Scripture, especially from the Gospels, that this was necessary to preserve the line of the Messiah. God's promises would stand. They always will stand. But as we think about the Messiah for a moment, as one commentator I read this week made a statement that put me on a path to think about the additional parallels that I believe we can see here. The solution, think about the solution here that ultimately will preserve the Messiah's lineage. It wasn't the removal of the death sentence. It's a second decree that neutralizes the first. Isn't that really a picture of the gospel message? Because of sin, there is a death decree on all mankind. The law has been written. The law of that says the wages of sin is death. For God to be just and holy, this law has to remain in effect. It cannot be revoked. It cannot be eliminated. But it can be neutralized by a second law, the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the law which Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:21 that God made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. The law that states that sin requires death is neutralized by the law that states that Christ's death can replace that of the sinners. Ultimately, all Scripture points to Christ. I believe we can see even here in Esther tonight a parallel to what Christ did for us when he took our sin upon himself. He fulfilled the first law by neutralizing it with the second. Let's close in prayer.